2021 work session of the Portland City Council. Today's subject is digital equity. Commissioner Rubio, good morning.
Morning. Should I just take it from here?
Your show.
Okay, thank you. Well, as commissioner overseeing the Office of Community Technology, I see the critical importance of a digitally connected community. And as I've said before, one of the biggest disparities to emerge during this time has been the lack of internet and digital access for Portlanders, especially BIPOC and low-income communities. And I appreciate the work that the Office for Community Technology has done over the years on the Digital Equity Action Plan and the teamwork between OCT and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and on the COVID-19 digital divide response. The disparities that have been highlighted during the pandemic are not new and won't go away anytime soon. So I look forward to working with my fellow commissioners, the community, OCT, and all the relevant city bureaus to implement some audacious plans to bridge the digital divide in Portland. So now I'll turn it over to Elizabeth Fettes, Interim Director for the Office of Community Technology, for the presentation.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Like Commissioner Rubio said, my name is Elizabeth Perez. I'm the Interim Director for the Office for Community Technology. And I thank you all for the privilege to share the work that has been done in the name of digital equity and the possibilities for the future. OCT has worked with Multnomah County and Multnomah County Libraries on strategizing next steps for the city and county for several months. We even had a reflections event in March, just days before starting to work from home. The pandemic has not only highlighted, but worsened the inequities we see when it comes to technology, and furthermore, has had a great impact on educational outcomes, resource attainment, and employment and career advancement. Students without access will fall behind in meeting critical education milestones due to the lack of access. People without access can't apply for essential services they need during the pandemic. And those who can, using phones, are sometimes required to fill out online forms that are not accessible by phone. You can't apply for most jobs without access. Even jobs that don't require computer knowledge or know-how require job seekers to apply online. This includes the city of Portland. These tools, once considered a luxury, are now essential to living and thriving in our world today. These issues won't go away once COVID-19 is contained. Our residents will continue to need devices, internet access to the home, and training. Our goal for today is to share with you the work that has been done over the last few years, the data that gives us insight into what this work has accomplished and what work yet has to be done, and stories from our community members to get a sense of what real people in our community are facing. I wanted to make sure that City Council is able to weigh in on what strategies, goals, and objectives should be in the deep phase two, before a final plan is brought to council for adoption. We want to work with you on identifying the areas in which we believe the city of Portland can have the most impact and what resources we can dedicate to ensuring all Portlanders have the ability to live and thrive in this digitally dependent world. We have several speakers today, and I will try to keep things on track to make sure we have time to hear from everyone and have plenty of time for discussion at the end. Each speaker has a presentation, and I reserved 5 minutes at the end of each presentation for questions. We do have one change today. Joanne Hovis from CCC is sick and will not be able to talk to us about the municipal broadband feasibility study. I will do my best to step in, which will be likely a lot of reading talking points. And I have also asked Jacob Barkas from Multnomah County to talk about our next steps. So I'm now going to just turn it over to Rebecca Gibbons and Matt Timberlake for their presentation on the Digital Equity Action Plan Phase 1.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Just give me a second to share my screen. Can everybody see that?
Yep, that looks good.
Okay, great. So good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Gibbons, Digital Inclusion Program Manager with the Office for Community Technology. I'm here with Matthew Timberlake to present an overview of the Digital Equity Action Plan, or as we call it, the DEAP. Matt and I will be switching in and out to present to you this morning. So Matt?
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Matthew Timberlake, IT Project Manager with Multnomah County and Multnomah County Library. both founding member organizations of the Digital Inclusion Network. So to start off, I'd like to ground us all in the definitions of digital equity and digital inclusion. Digital equity is when everyone has the information technology they need for full participation in our society, our economy, and our democracy. Digital equity is now recognized as a requirement for civic and cultural participation, employment, education, health, and access to essential services. Digital inclusion is how we ensure that all individuals and communities with the focus on equity and the BIPOC community have access. Digital inclusion has long been defined in terms of the three legs of the stool. You've probably heard that. It's an affordable computer, a reliable, affordable broadband connection, and training and support. And we've learned that another important piece is applications and content that's designed by and for all communities. Our understanding of the work of digital inclusion has to evolve as technology evolves. So digital equity is our goal, and digital inclusion is how we get there. The Digital Equity Action Plan sets forth a vision and mission that is grounded in equity. Rebecca.
So City Council, along with the County Board of Commissioners and the Library Board, adopted the DEEP in 2016. It's a strategic plan developed using a collective effort model that is nationally recognized. Not only is the partnership between the city, county, and library unique, and one that we celebrate since it opens lines of communication and resource sharing among us, we are also recognized in the national digital inclusion space for having one of the first community coalitions. In fact, in October of just this last year, we were one of 14 communities nationwide to be named an NDIA Digital Inclusion Trailblazer, a designation we achieved back in 2016 for the creation of the DEEP, and again now for our years of collective effort. The Digital Inclusion Network, or DIN, allows us to bring community voices to the table to design and lead our digital inclusion efforts. DIN members represent community nonprofits on the front lines of digital literacy training, local government agencies, businesses, schools, and libraries. We've been very fortunate to have this structure as it really helps us to foster awareness, collaboration, and community leadership on this issue. The DEEP framework focuses our DIN discussions on how we can collectively help residents who experience race, income, ability, and age barriers. The DEEP outlines five goals that the DIN members helped identify as important to overcoming these barriers, and these are access to the internet and devices. Access in many cases refers to the affordability of internet service and computers for low-income residents. Training and support. We know that adoption is achieved only when consistent, culturally responsive training and support is available. Leadership and capacity building. Working towards digital equity takes a village and clear, coordinated efforts. Digital economy. The pandemic, as you've heard, has clearly highlighted the importance of digital access for housing, health, education, public safety, economic opportunities, and civic engagement. And finally, policy. For our efforts to address digital equity barriers to hold, we need to continue to pursue meaningful public policy.
So the DEEP also outlines 17 strategic action areas to support those goals. And among those were are addressing internet access. So that's infrastructure as well as cost and other barriers. Expanding access to devices, including participation in device reuse programs like those offered by FreeGeek. Creating resources that provide culturally specific digital literacy training and support. Developing ways to share data that supports our work, including legislative updates. Ensuring effective practices among the DIN that address barriers to digital inclusion. So since adoption of the plan, we've taken action under each of these 17 strategic action areas and tracked and reported our progress back. And these efforts by DIN members and lead partners, mostly without dedicated funding, is carried out because they recognize that digital access is essential for the communities that they serve. So access training and support, goals one and two. I'd like to take a minute to just tell you about a few of our efforts. Multnomah County Library is a founding DIN member, and like most library systems, we've long been the leading provider of digital inclusion in our community. In the years before COVID, the library routinely provided as many as 1 million Wi-Fi sessions and hosted over 800,000 public access computing sessions. That's where we give somebody a computer for an hour or two. We would do that every year. And the library has also hosted hundreds of free computer classes every year. Even during COVID, we've provided extended Wi-Fi access and even outdoor public access computing in tents when weather permitted. The DIN also supports the Welcome to Computers program. DIN partners, the library, Free Geek, and Metro East Community Media work with community-based organizations to enroll residents in culturally specific computer training courses in their language. And everyone who completes the course goes home with a free laptop computer from Free Geek and 1 year of technical support. With support from DIN members, Free Geek has also expanded business and government participation in its computer recycling program, including Multnomah County. And we've worked with DIN members to keep DIN members informed about available internet service options. And with the ISPs at the DIN table, the providers have been able to hear directly from DIN members about the barriers to access. And the ISPs can also share new digital inclusion efforts with the organizations that serve the people who need access most. Other programs recently in COVID, Multnomah County Library has given away 500 internet cards and we're ramping up Chromebook lending significantly. Okay, leadership and capacity building. So the DIN meets monthly to report on deep progress, to collaborate and build new partnerships, share updates on state and federal digital inclusion efforts, and present on new programs and initiatives. The DIN database identifies digital inclusion services and resources from local government, community-based organizations, schools, libraries, and businesses working with underserved communities. The DIN also created the Pandemic Action Tracker, which has tracked digital inclusion efforts by DIN organizations throughout the pandemic. And DIN members have also participated in the city's Digital Divide Work Group, which I know you'll be hearing more about later. DIN members have raised awareness of digital equity and increased knowledge of critical digital equity issues and programs, and having that network has really supported early action on getting people connected during the pandemic. Next slide. So digital economy and policy. We provide regular updates on policy issues and legislation at the local, state, and federal level for our DIN members. We champion programs like the annual National Digital Inclusion Week events by DIN members. We have held local Digital Inclusion Network summits, which have featured addresses by the mayor of Portland. Thank you. By the chair of Multnomah County and the director of libraries, and hosted roundtables of local organizations focused on supporting economic opportunity through digital inclusion initiatives. We're closely involved in the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, with many DIN members being frequent speakers and panelists at national conferences. And Portland will be hosting the next Net Inclusion Conference coming up hopefully in 2022. And we've also provided periodic deep progress reports, and those have been unanimously approved by both the City Council and the County Commissioners. All of these efforts over the last 4 years have not only raised awareness, they've informed policy decisions at many levels and improved our community's ability to respond to the pandemic. We are recognized as nationally as a leader. So in addition to being an NDIA trailblazer, the DEEP won the National Telecommunications Officers and Advisors 2016 Community Broadband Strategic Plan of the Year Award. And here in Oregon, the DIN won the Excellence in Telecommunications Partnerships Award for 2018. Rebecca?
So in addition to sharing out about successful projects and strategies, we've also identified some overall lessons learned. Just for example, I'll just go over a couple of them. A digital inclusion plan is the starting point for coordinating local efforts and facilitating partnership building among community anchor institutions. And dedicated backbone staff support provided by the city and the library is still strongly supported by the community. Another one is, reasons for non-adoption are really personal and complex. While affordability is the primary issue, there are also many other interrelated issues influencing full digital adoption, things like trust in the internet provider, privacy and security concerns, and language barriers. Trusted community organizations are some of our most influential in increasing awareness of training opportunities and discount internet service options. And outreach to vulnerable populations is really essential to helping people feel welcome and safe. Digital literacy training really needs to be ongoing for digital adoption to occur. Teaching people how to use a broadband connection from home is critical, not just from school or work or a community center. And finally, we really do need to remain mindful so we're not creating new barriers along the way. So when the DEEP was created in 2016, using national data available at the time, we estimated about 15% of households in our community were without a home broadband connection. Today, national and local data shows fewer households are lacking access, but we still estimate at least 70,000 Portland residents, many of them students and seniors, who don't have internet connection at home. Working to address the barriers to digital equity is a process that takes time and resources, but we know what's needed and we have dedicated partners involved. Our efforts so far has faced policy and resource challenges. Under the past federal administration and FCC, there have been changes in federal telecommunications policy that has directly impacted our ability to effectively negotiate digital inclusion benefits with industry providers who use the public right-of-way for their for-profit services. And while some of these providers have legitimately put forward digital inclusion programs, the programs are often developed on a national scale and are designed within the industry's for-profit model. And they don't take into account local needs and circumstances, and sometimes leave out our community-based partners. We also face resource challenges. State and federal funding programs so far have been focused on rural, unserved communities, not urban communities like ours that face a different type of access issue. So since the adoption of the DEEP, with the exception of some one-time external funding support garnered by DIN member organizations like Open Signal and Free Geek and the library, DEEP implementation and progress is based solely on staff time dedicated. But there are also opportunities. We are in the process of updating the DEEP, as Elizabeth mentioned, and we take a look at what worked and what needs improvement. Back in March, we did hold a DEEP 2.0 planning event and DIN members, and we used this time to reflect on the past few years of DEEP implementation and to begin to plan for what the community wants to see in the phase two strategic plan. As part of that process, we did partner with the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission to evaluate progress and assess the needs and barriers and interests of residents, nonprofits, schools, libraries, and others related to their digital access. We do have CBG, and you'll be hearing about the Muni Broadband Report here today to share with you what we learned about the access and adoption barriers, and also about the community's expectations for the role of the city in addressing the needs. So Matt and I just wanted to close by saying that just having a plan has elevated the issue of digital equity. We've raised awareness and drawn national attention for our local efforts. It's also essential to position us to be ready to go after new state and federal funding. We've seen in the last stimulus bill a $3.2 billion investment in a broadband benefit program. And we are anticipating new state and federal programs that support digital literacy coming online, hopefully by the end of this year. And these opportunities require that we come in with a strong strategic plan in place. So that concludes our overview. And I think we have a few minutes for questions before we invite Tom and Tony up.
Are there any initial questions?
I have a quick one. excuse me. Anyway, great presentation so far. You mentioned what needs improvement, but I didn't hear anything concrete. Like what's an example of what needs improvement?
Yeah, so I think the areas of improvement for us in the phase two deep plan that we're looking at are more concrete strategies. The Digital Inclusion Network has identified effective practices, but our current digital equity plan is fairly broad. It has some strategies that we've worked under, but those strategies could be expanded upon, be a little bit more targeted for communities that we've identified that are experiencing specific barriers, and include more specific short-term and long-term goals and performance metrics. So we're hoping in the next phase two plan that we'll be bringing forward that you'll see a lot more specific projects being proposed. And we're hoping to that along with that, that we might be able to garner some resources internally and externally to move these issues forward. I think you've seen with the city's digital equity work group and the stimulus, the CARES Act funding that was devoted to that project, that with a little bit of seed funding, we are able to make a larger impact in the community.
Thank you, Rebecca.
I'll just add that like a lot of organizations, the DIN is working towards being a proactively anti-racist organization. And we have looked at a lot of the things that impact how we approach having membership in the DIN. So this has been an eye-opening year for all of us, but for example, we used to meet downtown regularly at city offices once a month. Well, that actually created a lot of barriers for people who would like to attend DIN meetings. And we had a conference call line, but of course that's not really participation if you're just listening to 15 or 20 people or more sitting around a conference table. So we are, that's just one example of areas in which we're looking at how we can increase DIN membership and participation.
Thank you, Matthew. That was really clear. And just now I really appreciate stories like that. We're all trying to improve all the time. So it's not a gotcha moment. It's just exciting to hear what you've learned and how you're moving forward. Thanks.
Mr. Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you both for that fabulous presentation. I'm actually curious about the quality of service that people are getting through the city's program. And let me just give a little bit of background. What we know is that parents are working from home, kids are trying to work from home. What we know is that many households don't have enough computers for the kids that need to access it. And we know that the more people that are online, the less good the connection becomes, right? And so I'm really curious as to whether or not as you review the broadband study, for me, I guess I'm just troubled by paying cable companies money that they should actually be providing to low-income people so that they have access to the best internet connection that they could have. And it feels like what we're doing is rewarding companies that are overcharging all of us for services that we all need and use. So is there any... So I guess that's a few questions. So one, what's going on around the broadband, the study, and did we find anything promising there? Two, where are the cable companies and what is their investment in making sure that digital access is available for low-income people and people of color and people that have multiple kids that are trying to access that information? So I'll stop. I have a lot more questions, but I'll stop there.
And Commissioner, if it's all right with you, I'd like to put a pin in those questions because I do want to get through the community needs ascertainment and the Muni broadband feasibility study. And I think through those presentations, we'll get a few more answers there.
I appreciate that. I'm happy to wait. Thanks.
Great. We will get to those.
A suggestion, Elizabeth, why don't we go through all the presentations?
All of them?
And then we can write our questions down and then we'll, because my suspicion is you're going to answer some of the questions we have now.
That's good.
Is that okay, colleagues? Just give me a head nod if that's okay. So why don't
Perfect.
You run through all the presentations? We'll give everybody the chance to speak, and then we'll write our questions down and ask them all when you're all through.
Sounds good. Then I will turn things over to Tom Robinson and Tony Tabora Roberts to talk about the community needs ascertainment.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. My name is Tom Robinson and president of CBG Communications, and we were hired by the MHCRC to do a community needs ascertainment that had a cable television renewal component to it and gathering data for that, but also was largely focused on broadband access, internet access applications for that type of access, as well as a number of other issues. So what we wanted to present today was to drill down on three of those issues: affordability of broadband service, which we found to be a huge problem, education and training, and then finally the role of local government. We asked several questions in both a statistically valid telephone survey as well as a qualitative online survey related to that. So with me also is Tony Tawara Roberts with Esper House. Esper House did a specific part of the study focused on engagement with underserved communities, and she'll talk about some of those activities and findings. And then also on the phone, Christine Rivers, who's our senior research associate, her internet, as it happens, we're in the middle of an ice storm here in the Northeast, so it's been winking out. Hopefully mine will stay where it needs to be, or I'll be joining you on telephone as well. All right, so I'll go ahead and share my screen. Let's see if I can bring up the appropriate document here. Let's see. Let me find that. In a second. Well, I don't quite see the document I'm looking for. Let me pull it up on the screen and then hit share screen. Let me try that first. I still don't see it. Let me try it one more time. Ah, there it is. Okay. Share screen. All right, here we go. Okay, let me start it from selection. Right. Okay, can everybody see that?
Yep.
Okay. All right, good. All right, I think we got it going now. All right, so the study was extensive. It covered a wide range of what we would consider community technology needs and interest. It dealt with the residential community, the business community, a lot of stakeholders and sectors, those folks that use the institutional network that connect a lot of government and educational facilities, people within the public school districts at the higher education level, the community media, personnel and users from Open Signal and Metro East, a lot of cable-related constituencies, and covered all the demographic populations within the MHCRC member jurisdictions, the city, the county, and the East County cities. So we went at it different ways. The statistically valid scientific residential telephone survey was implemented for 630 residents across the city and the county and the East County cities. And with telephone surveys, even with, these days with folks at home for the pandemic, but most of this data was gathered prior to the stay-at-home orders, it's sometimes difficult to catch people. So the phone surveys themselves tend to be shorter. So we also instituted a qualitative public online survey so we could ask more questions, drill down, provide more detail, provide the, if you will, provide the why behind the what. So if we got an answer, we would ask in the a qualitative survey, additional questions about why someone would feel that way or what they were experiencing. We also did an online community media producer user survey, a lot of workshops, focus groups, had one with the Multnomah Libraries, the public agencies from all the MHCRC member jurisdictions, Digital Inclusion Network gave us a lot of data and information from their specific efforts. OHSU, we met with their telehealth professionals, and this again was prior to the pandemic. And if you read the report and go into the notes from that discussion, they were almost prescient in the way that they were able to understand that if something were to happen, here's what would happen to telehealth. That's very interesting. And then one of the equity advisors from the Smart City PDX initiative. Since CTC was doing a rather extensive business community survey, we leveraged the data from that survey for some of our findings and to compare to what we were finding from people and their experiences in employment. And then finally, the Esper House underserved communities qualitative data collection. And Tony, you want to jump in and talk about that a bit?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Hello, Mayor and Commissioners. Thanks for having us. Yeah, we were brought on to work and try to engage with three specific target groups that MHCRC identified. Racially and ethnically diverse communities, people with disabilities, and seniors. And so we designed a process of working with groups that we had relationships with and folks who had interest in this work, and based on their capacity, sort of designed a process. And Tom, you can go to the next slide. So we ended up doing a number of engagement sessions with both community leaders from these target groups, as well as three specific community-based partner organizations. And those included Open School East, ARP North Northeast, and then Northwest Housing Alternatives at their Oaks apartment building downtown. And we also, in terms of the community leaders, we had folks like APANO, Latino Network, Friends of Noise, The Contingent. So a wide range of groups represented in amongst these focus engagement groups. And then we also did some one-on-one interviews to be able to dive a little deeper with individuals from some of these communities. And then some of those groups were able to do a little bit of outreach also for the survey. Frankly, the survey also did provide it was a little bit inaccessible for particularly groups of folks who needed accessibility issue, accessibility in terms of language or for disability needs. So it was only available to folks in Spanish and English. So that was one barrier. So we can go to the next. I think that was basically, oh yeah. So I'll send it back to you, Tom.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Tony. And we do appreciate all the outreach. The online survey achieved 442 really detailed surveys with pages and pages of comments, open-coded responses to different questions, especially, you know, comments at the end. If we didn't cover something that you wanted to talk about, you know, what else, you know, would you want us to know? So if you have a chance to read that in the exhibits to the report, you'll find some really interesting experiences and some that really provide direction for how to, especially as a local government, how to react and respond to meet those needs. So we'll start with affordability. We found, as many studies find, that people are less likely to have internet at home. And when we're saying internet at home, we're talking about wireline internet service, because some people do have internet at home, but they only use their smartphones. And so we made sure to understand what the depth and breadth of need was for wireline internet service, which is largely broadband these days. 18% of the households across the MHCRC area did not have such access. That was 16% in Portland. So you can imagine, since Portland, from a proportional standpoint, was a large part of Portland residents were a large part of the overall survey, that the number was much higher in the county and outside of the East County cities. 43% previously had wireline service, but they stopped because they either perceived that it wasn't needed or it was too costly. And if you look at that last bullet, national data suggests that for many, a lack of need or desire is due to affordability, and they just don't want to say that. For those that had never had wireline internet at home, again, a high percentage, no need, no desire, and 29% indicated it was too costly. What national data suggests, and this was prior to the pandemic, is that a study done by Pew, is that that number is really only at about 10% that really have no need or no desire. People who express that largely have some other issue, and it's typically related to costs and where it's related to education. And that's another thing we'll talk about. So in the qualitative survey, we were able to drill down farther and find out what people felt was an affordable monthly cost, whatever they were paying now. 19% of those respondents indicated free, and that was largely in communities of color and seniors, and 67% of seniors over 75 years old. A reasonable cost, so then we asked them what a reasonable cost was, and underserved communities indicated that they're paying now an average between $51 and $100 per month for home internet, sometimes a higher cost because of some of the accessibility issues. And they indicate that 41 to 50, or about half of that, is a reasonable amount to pay. And then finally, we asked people whether they delayed or avoided paying other important bills, including heat and light and power bills, as well as other types of utilities. And they report paying $50 or more per month, what they really believe is reasonable, or an amount that they can afford, is roughly one third to one half of that, $15 to $30. Tony, I'll turn it back to you related to devices.
Yeah, I do think that one of our findings was that there was some skepticism from a lot of the folks that we talked to about the role of government in how to address these issues. But there really was a lot of belief that the government should provide or subsidize internet devices and access. And then some of the folks that we talked to who actually have some of those devices, what they call the Obama phone, those types of things, that those don't really even work very well. So they would often have to even still get another service, even if they were provided a subsidized phone. So that was one of the findings we just wanted to share from the folks that we talked to.
Okay, thank you, Tony. So that leads right into one of the findings from the qualitative survey. We were again able to ask some more questions about reasons or barriers from getting or using communications technologies. And there was a wide range of them, but typically devices to access the internet, to utilize applications on the internet, broadband service versus having just internet service. And you can see 76% of those that needed something indicated cost slash affordability was their biggest single issue. And we allowed multiple responses. That's why it will add up to 100%. Besides cost, a primary factor in non-adoption is a lack of understanding and training. And again, this sometimes is something where people will mask that by saying, oh, well, I really don't need it, I have no desire for it, or my smartphone is all I need. It's not really that when you are able to engage them at a little deeper level than sometimes surveys can do. It's lack of understanding, lack of training. Tony, you want to jump back in?
Yeah, and you know, the education and training that is available, sometimes it was not really meeting the needs of folks who we talked to. So for instance, seniors experienced that, one person shared that the training that they went to, and actually I think the quote is on the next slide, is just that it was too fast and they couldn't keep up and they really needed something even more basic. Also, I think the difference between, internet and internet access versus Wi-Fi, I'm sorry, versus you know, access on your phone and how those interacted. Like, people didn't really understand when they were accessing one or the other. So there's just really basic things that folks didn't understand. And then, of course, for like culturally specific communities, like such as communities of color or folks who need culturally relevant trainings, they exist in certain platforms that maybe aren't available, that don't have available trainings, or of course different languages. And then also, so for persons who are living with disabilities, both the cost of the things that allow them to access the digital tools that they need, and then also the training to be able to learn how to use those tools are a factor to why those are not accessible to them. And then when the folks that they do trust to be able to help train and educate them on these issues are these organizations such as, you know, the public libraries, as we heard earlier, and then the community-based organizations. A lot of those are members of the DIN. And then also just their fellow community members, you know, or their family members are also trusted entities. So so that's, and then these are just some of those quotes. So yeah, there's an Android class I complained about. The guy was rushing and wouldn't slow down. And then they wouldn't let me use my own phone. so they gave this other phone. And so that just didn't really make sense to this, this senior I talked to. And then another example is Chinese seniors at Portland Manor, which is an apartment building. You know, they know how to use their smartphone for just certain things, but they could use it to actually access bus schedules. So having the a community organization be able to help train them was a way to help them access that. And then this last example is from someone from the blind community who said a lot of the students actually have this software, but they don't have the skills to use it. So like at school, their PCC is required to provide that tool for them, but they're not actually required to train them how to use it. So, so that's an interesting conundrum that we found. So back to you, Tony. Okay.
All right, thanks, Tony. All right, so last set of slides. So what does the community want from its local government? Well, as Tony said, the trusted approach for training is really from partnerships with trusted community organizations and entities with culturally specific community members and trainings, things like that. But one of the biggest things we found is that the respondents to the surveys and within some of the focus groups as well, they want their local government to work to ensure that all persons have affordable access to the internet at home. And you see that's such a huge issue is the affordability of access. And the scientific survey, you can see that it came out 61% essential or very important, even higher from the qualitative survey. And you might expect that from, you know, from an online community that would be responding. We asked them, do they consider it an essential utility, as essential to them as electricity? And in the scientific survey, it was right along that, you know, that marginal yes-no line, 50% yes, 48% no. Remember, this was prior to the pandemic, prior to the stay-at-home orders. National data would suggest that that number has leaped substantially. And you can see, again, from the online community, the qualitative survey, those that are familiar with using online services and a wide range of them, it was 87%. As public and businesses, CTC found this in their survey, and we found it as well, are continuing to increasingly view internet service as an essential utility, local governments may need to develop a higher level of involvement. This was about choice of more than one internet service provider. 58% in the qualitative survey said it was essential, 25% very important. And then public policies that protect security and privacy of an individual's information was viewed very highly. This is from the scientific survey. A margin of error on the survey of plus or minus 3.9%. So, you know, the findings have a great degree of statistical validity. There are protections against your service provider selling or sharing your personal information, 44% essential, 44% very important, or almost 9 out of 10. Your service providers don't monitor your service without your authorization. Again, 97% combined essential and very important. And then finally, from the qualitative public survey, do they want their local government to ensure public safety and neighborhood aesthetics and overall quality of life? This is kind of the balancing act between providing new technologies that use the public right away. Yes, you know, 55% essential, 26% very important. Your local government ensures that public safety is not negatively impacted. And then essentially a lower combined finding, but still at about 2/3, your local government ensures that aesthetics and overall quality of life are not negatively impacted by new technologies in your neighborhood, but rather positively impacted. All right, and this is typically where we go to questions, but that's it for our team for now. Let me stop.
Thanks, Tom and Tony, I appreciate it. So like I had said, CTC was supposed to be with us today, and unfortunately she is sick, so I am going to do my best to fill in, but know that a really comprehensive overview we can do in the future with Joanne. So I'm just going to go over some highlights from the study. And so, you know, at the same time that the community needs ascertainment was going on, there was an initiative spearheaded by the county to do a review of, is municipal broadband feasible in this county? And so that is really kind of one solution to all of the issues that we heard from the CBG study. As you've already heard, you know, I think what we saw, you know, in the through the pandemic is that high-speed, reliable broadband at home is critical for work, healthcare, and education. More than half of the people surveyed said they needed internet access at home for their jobs. And this was pre-pandemic. So cable right now is the most used internet technology, but fiber performs the best. The other thing, as CBG pointed out, is that there is a high level of trust in the community for city and county to do the work when it comes to internet access. So we had 6 in 10 respondents say government should work to ensure access. That is, you know, one of those findings that we found, you know, gives the city and county a sort of mandate to work on this. There's also high support for a government owned fiber network, higher in Portland than it is for the East County cities. But that support drops when the price to switching to a new provider increases beyond $50 a month. So what we heard in this study is that building a countywide fiber to the premises network would cost an estimated $1 billion. And would require that at least 36% of customers switch to the county service at $80 a month, which is much higher than we think people are willing to pay. When we talk about lowering that price to $50 a month, the take rate then goes, we need a 60 to 70% take rate. So pretty difficult to do, but not infeasible. There are different ways of doing a municipal broadband. A public-private partnership could allow governments to more affordably own long-term infrastructure and secure our policy objectives of increasing access. So it's not completely off the table, but it would have much more risk to go with a full-on municipal broadband at the moment. CTC also did provide some options for doing some stopgap measures to increase equity through the pandemic and in the short term. So expanding Wi-Fi hotspots at any or all of the more than 600 government school and library locations in the county, creating a fixed wireless network to serve low-income neighborhoods, and then support direct subsidies for low-income residents paying for existing service. So going back to Commissioner Hardesty's concern about, you know, funneling more money into the companies, I don't necessarily know that the last one is something that we want to do, but it is a stopgap measure. Jacob Farkas from Multnomah County has graciously agreed last minute to jump in here and talk about what the county is doing going forward, what is our short-term plan, and how the county, along with member jurisdictions, including Portland, are moving forward on what we want to do about internet for our residents.
Hey, thanks, Elizabeth. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today. So as Elizabeth noted, we our partnership, which included the cities of Portland, Gresham, Wood Village, Fairview, Troutdale, and Multnomah County, embarked on the feasibility study really starting about 2 years ago, working with CTC to perform this study. This group had a really clear focus. The goal was to provide CTC with the information they needed to perform their study and get this through to the end, to really just get like that final report and understand what the learnings were. What we discovered along the way is this was a really great partnership of these cities. We each have a desire to look at digital equity and find ways to improve things for our residents. And so once the feasibility study was released and finalized, we wanted to make sure to continue and stay together and work as a partnership. But what we needed to do was kind of figure out what our purpose was. Again, it was really clear in that phase one that we needed to get the study out and understand the outcomes. And now with phase two, we wanted to come back together and figure out the best way to continue working together. So after lots of meetings and discussions, I'll read to you what came out of our charter, which is kind of defines what our purpose is moving forward, at least into the second phase. We are a cross-agency organization consortium providing input and expertise into recommendations to address the high-speed internet connectivity needs of county residents and participating agencies where feasible. This group will provide specific focus on improving equity and access and affordability to BIPOC communities, seniors, special needs, disabled, and low-income populations, as well as those experiencing homelessness and other emerging communities where equitable access is a challenge. So that is really what the focus is of this group moving forward. And one of the main things that we want to do is keep the lines of communication open among the cities. We know that we can learn from one another. And I think a really great example is tomorrow at our meeting, Elizabeth and representatives from the city of Portland are going to come talk about the Smart Cities PDX initiative and the money that they received through CARES and how they push that out to the community. And what they've figured out is a template on how to use federal funding in a way to serve the community residents. And it is certainly something that the rest of us can learn from, whether it's the county or some of the other smaller cities. Here's a successful application of federal funding. And having this group together provides a great opportunity to learn from one another and be able to apply that to the other municipalities if or when more federal funding comes down the line. The other thing we want to continue to do is work together on opportunities where there might be cross-jurisdictional possibilities, understanding what each of the different cities is trying to accomplish from an internet connectivity perspective, and where we might be able to join and help one another. At one of our previous meetings, we were able to have the county's senior grants coordinator just come and talk about grant funding and help some of the people understand what you might want to prepare and have available and ready to go once that, you know, the trigger hits and we're able to start applying for federal grants. So we really just want to see this group as it moves forward, work together, continue to communicate, find opportunities to help one another, and continue this conversation, because as we know, it's incredibly important, and we want to make sure and try to, you know, solve, you know, what problems we can in the manner in which makes the most sense. So again, this group continues to meet monthly for now. It is the same consortium of municipalities from the feasibility study. And then we're also exploring what other partners might make sense to join this group as we move forward. So thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Jacob. Thanks so much for jumping in last minute. I am now going to turn things over. I think that was a great segue to the COVID-19 digital divide response. So I'll turn it over to Christine Kendrick from the Smart City PDX team and Jenny Lee from the Coalitions of Communities of Color.
All right, good morning. Mayor and City Commissioners, my name is Jenny Lee and I'm the Deputy Director at the Coalition of Communities of Color. I served on the executive team of the City's Digital Divide Response Project. And I'm here today to present with the city to briefly highlight the impacts of this project, what we learned from creating a community-led group to implement the response actions. I'll begin this presentation, and then Christine Kendrick from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability Smart City PDX team will close out the slides. So next slide. With the COVID-19 pandemic, many of us saw a rapid increase in our dependence on technology. But for many Portlanders, especially Black, Indigenous, people of color, and people with disabilities, they saw an increase in the digital divide. The lack of affordable and reliable internet access, devices, and digital literacy training increased existing economic, social, and educational inequities. For those experiencing the digital divide, there are also increased risks since pandemic information, access to resources, and social connection are primarily online. Internet connectivity can be the only safe way for some communities to access critical services. Next slide. Portlanders in the city rely on frontline community-serving organizations as trusted partners. They help to share out information, distribute resources, and facilitate community engagement with local government. Communities of partners brought forward to city leadership and staff the digital divide impacts they were hearing from community members early in the pandemic response. They also shared the need for new digital support and ways to build digital community, since traditional outreach tools were unavailable in a time of physical distancing. These impacts, needs, and partnerships led to the creation of a technology kit pilot implemented in the spring of 2020. Lessons from this pilot then informed the project to be scaled up for the CARES Act digital divide response. Next slide, please. With just over $5 million in CARES Act funding, the project partnered with 24 community organizations to provide technology kit resources to Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and people living with disabilities. The technology kit resources included 3,500 Chromebooks, 500 with built-in cellular connectivity, and one-year unlimited data plans, 547 iPads and protective cases for people with disabilities, 8,429 internet assistance cards so individual Portlanders can decide the best method for their connectivity needs, comprehensive warranties and tech support for Chromebooks and iPads, accessories for individuals with disabilities, stylus, keyboards, etc., and training support created in multiple languages. And the training resources are available not just to technology kit recipients, but anyone with questions about Chromebooks, iPads, internet safety, privacy, how to use video conferencing platforms, accessibility settings, and more topics. All training resources and videos can be found on the website now at the bottom of this slide. Next slide, please. Selecting the 24 community partner organizations listed on the slide to distribute technology kit resources were not easy choices by the executive team. 113 community organizations applied to the technology kit application over a period of just 5 business days, and the request far exceeded the resources available. Partnering with smaller organizations to build new relationships and digital community support were goals of the work group. Around half of the selected partners have 6 or less full-time employees, and approximately 30% have 4 or less full-time employees. Operational support for partners in the application for training, distribution, and data collection were also a key project design, given the time and added responsibilities so many of these partners continue to experience during the pandemic. Next slide, please. there was active community leadership in the project design, implementation, and outcomes. This was made possible through the COVID-19 response digital divide workgroup structure, intentionally designed by and with community. I served in a decision-making role on the executive team, which was a mixture of community members and city staff. Based on the workgroup charter, the team maintained a membership that was small, 7 to 9 members, so we could be responsive and move quickly on decisions. The majority of members identified as BIPOC, and the majority were also community members, that is to say, non-city staff. There were many decisions to make on a weekly basis, from technology kit application design, outreach plans, partner selections, technology device and internet contract decisions, problem solving due to global manufacturing delays, and changes in needs or capacity by partners. So we met weekly throughout the project, sometimes twice a week if needed. But the community participation did not stop at the executive team. Many volunteered their time or added to their job by participating in stakeholder roles on our frontline outreach and training sub-teams. In these teams, stakeholders gathered to discuss questions from the executive team, share experiences and expertise, make recommendations to the executive team to inform our decision making, and then community members also helped lead and facilitate team meetings as well. Executive team members and collective stakeholders have provided feedback on the value they experienced through this type of work group model. Key points are that it was flexible to participate in given your current availability. There were clear actions to work on together. It was responsive and fast moving, and limitations of grant funding or city policy were clearly communicated. But it's important to highlight here that this model required time, energy, and expertise from volunteers and significant support from city staff. Creating and supporting a process that is community-led needs commitment from leadership that city staff can act on those decisions from community. Engaging those most impacted or the organizations that work with those most impacted takes resources and time. Collective decisions, meeting agendas, project materials, and follow-up with community members need to be directed and shared with as much advance notice as possible. Support needs to be provided so that those volunteering their time are clear on what they're contributing to. And the time and effort from community and staff need to be supported, planned for, and funded. This process was unique. It came out of a conscious decision to create a city-facilitated but not city-owned space, and one that was truly led by community. I believe that this model exemplified the city living up to its equity values during pandemic response. And I'll now hand it over to Christine, and thank you especially to Christine for your incredible work throughout this process.
Thank you, Jenny, so much for your work as an executive team member and co-presenting with us today and sharing your experience. Good morning, Council. My name is Christine Kendrick. I'm part of the Smart City PX team, the Bureau of Planning Sustainability, and I'll be sharing a little bit more background about the work group and the city collaboration. Next slide, please. Okay, sorry, did the slides advance? Thanks. Thank you, Kevin. So picture here is the structure of the revised work group designed with community. This structure and our charter specifically incorporated feedback from the pilot that to help improve this model and how we could iterate on it for the CARES Act project. So for example, community members asked for increased transparency and clear communication about how decisions would be made. So decision-making and stakeholder roles, as Jenny mentioned, were formally separated between the executive team and the sub-team. This formal separation was so that we could balance the challenge of centering that expertise that we needed from impacted communities and the organizations that work with them, but at the same time, not prevent organizations from applying for technology kit resources or contracting opportunities that would be made possible with this project. We set clear expectations up front that not all stakeholders would be able to make every single meeting. They wouldn't be able to review every document or every single decision that would come because of the compressed timeline. But we had core values and vision that guided us, and so that helped build the trust in this process. We also reviewed the overall project design and response actions with all stakeholders using the city's COVID-19 equity toolkit. One stakeholder described, as Jenny mentioned, their experience that it felt like I was working in a city facilitated space, but not a city owned space. And again, this feedback just really reflects that intentional design and the clear needs that were brought forward by community members at the beginning of this project. Next slide, please. Work group support and project implementation was also a collective city effort. The Bureau of Planning Sustainability and Office for Community Technology partnered to lead the work on behalf of the city, and Office of Equity and Human Rights was also an integral partner in this work. By having staff from multiple bureaus participate within the executive team, they participated within sub-teams, and also support project management needs, there was more knowledge about city policies and programs that were able to be shared with the community partners. This helped ensure that while we were creating collaboratively designed solutions and project components, we would be able to deliver on the community recommendations and ask, or also be upfront, maybe why we couldn't do it and let's work on a different solution as well together. Cross-bureau collaboration also increased the capacity of city staff team to help support more relationships with work group members. There are also many other bureaus I do want to mention here and offices that were key to the creative problem solving and the rapid implementation. Thank you so much to Grants Management, the Joint Volunteer Information JVIC team, Emergency Coordination Center, Procurement, City Attorneys, and more that made this project possible and allowed us to be able to support this type of work group. Bureau of Planning Sustainability, Office for Community Technology, and Office of Equity and Human Rights often work together. We have a history of working together that includes Smart City Steering Committee on our priorities framework, our citywide privacy principles, the community engagement for our face recognition policies, and now we're looking forward on to defining digital justice with community. This cross-bureau team also often includes city attorneys so that we can have a robust team ready to tackle policy and push forward to keep creating new participatory processes for data and technology decisions with Portlanders. Next slide. The last thing I'd like to share is a focus back on the continued disparities in the digital divide need and available support. You saw some of these numbers last week during the CARES Act work session. And we, as Jenny mentioned, we had 113 organizations apply for the technology kit, and those requests far exceeded what the project could support. So we only fulfilled 17% of Chromebook requests, 10% of iPad requests, and about 36% of internet assistance requests. This disparity in funding and resources available is also likely to be underestimated. The technology kit application was only open for about 5 business days, and that was because of the compressed timeline of the grant funding. Partner organizations have also shared with us that they have learned a lot, even more, about the increased needs through the project implementation. So, for example, one organization has shared, to their surprise, that up to 85% of their community members rely on cell phones only for internet connectivity. Some families and community members have also shared feeling like their eyes have been opened up to how digital connectivity devices and the internet and training support can really transform their lives in their homes, for their jobs and businesses. We will be analyzing our demographic data collected through this project and also collecting more qualitative stories of impact over the next month as we finish out this project. Next slide. For more information about our project and work group, these can be found online. And I know these slides will be shared out, so you'll have these links, and we will be ready for questions at the end of the work session. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jenny and Christine. That was a great presentation. Gives a good overview of what we can do with a little bit of money. So now I'm going to turn it over to our community members who were either involved in the COVID-19 response or through our digital inclusion network to share a little bit about what their communities are facing in their stories. So Napoleon, if you are on, take it away. Looks like we're having a little trouble hearing you.
Maybe you need to turn the volume up. We still can't hear you.
No.
Can you call in?
Yeah, if you can call in, that might be helpful.
Does he have your number, Elizabeth?
Mm-hmm.
There he is.
There he is.
I think
okay, so my phone has an audio lag. My phone has an audio lag, so it causes problems, okay? So first of all, good morning, Mr. Mayor, commissioners, morning. And everyone in attendance. My name is Napoleon Hodges. I'm the executive director slash commander of the National Association for Black Veterans, the Portland chapter. And our purpose is to provide support to military communities, also outreach to the our various community members through to provide access to jobs, food, housing, clothing, and other services through our community partners, such as the City of Portland. Now, I do not have a presentation. I just want to give our thoughts. Now, first of all, this program was an excellent program. NAVVES Portland was happy to be able to participate. And what we found was that we were able to allow a lot of individuals to step up their access to technology and their access to the internet through this program. And we couldn't have done it without the support of the project manager, Christine Kendrick, and her team, because they provided outstanding support throughout the process. So one of the things that we were looking at as far as the program goes, we found that the need far outweighed the resources available, as you have been discussing. So if this is a program that is going to continue, what I would suggest is that perhaps some of the resources be, the resource distribution be coordinated a little differently. And I'm thinking that it was probably impacted by the lockdown as well as the holiday season, as far as being able to get the resources to the community members. Because we had the Chromebooks, the iPads, and the internet cards that were delivered at different times that caused our outreach team to have to go back and repeat activities. But make no mistake, we were very happy to be part of this program. We saw how it impacted a lot of families. And I have to admit, we did have a feeling of more of a digital Santa Claus, because it came at the end of the year. 2020 was a very difficult year for many of us, but it allowed us to end the year on a good note. And basically, our feedback from our people that we talked to, the people that we connected with, and even the people who we're not able to connect with because of we ran out of resources, it was all positive. We had zero negative feedback. Everybody was just looking forward to the next iteration of this program. And if it happens, and if we're allowed to be part of that, we would certainly step up and take that opportunity. And I'm done.
Thank you so much. Yuvia, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. My name is Yuvia Morello, and I'm president of the local nonprofit, the Portland Indigenous Marketplace. We were honored to be one of the recipients of the City of Portland's technology kits. This opportunity was a much needed boost of technology connectivity in our community of Indigenous artists in a time when technology has become a necessity. Prior to COVID, as an organization, our focus was hosting and organizing in-person marketplaces for Indigenous artists. We had formally and informally provided this resource for our community for over 3 years. So we are a new organization with recent 501c3 status. We don't have any paid staff. So when COVID hit and all in-person activities were canceled, there was a time that we felt like we had been canceled too as an organization and as a community. What were we going to do? After our board formally organized through Zoom, our leadership realized that we had to try and do something for our community of Indigenous artists, because we were all lacking an inline presence, sales, and or exposure. So we started to host virtual Portland Indigenous marketplaces. Locally, we were the only Indigenous organization that hosts Marketplace to not cancel any of our scheduled dates for 2020. But while we began this journey into the online world, many of our artists were not able to participate because of countless barriers to connecting to the internet, comfort online, converting their businesses to an online format, and surviving a pandemic. All of this to say that the needs are great in our community, and the switch to a virtual marketplace was one of the, you know, countless switches that we've had to make this year to move everything online. But not all of us, you know, were able to make that switch. There are so many of us that don't have that connectivity. And as mentioned before, through this project, we found out that many of our artists were only connecting to the internet through their phones, trying to run a business on their phones. The technology kits have lessened the barriers listed above for our Portland resident artists. More support would be greatly appreciated as this project deepened our understanding of digital needs in our community, for our toddlers to our elders. I want to share a few reactions of the recipients of technology kits. And I wrote these down the day of our distribution, which I can fully recognize that feeling of being digital Santa, because we were able to hold on to everything to distribute, well, almost everything. The iPads came a little bit later. But we also were able to combine that distribution with a payment that we were making and some other gift cards. So it was this beautiful gift to all our families in Portland. That was the only part that we couldn't serve everybody. But a couple recipients shared, my grandma just passed. My mother is in the hospital with COVID. I have to travel soon. My husband is out of work and parents are stressed. And we as parents are stressing for the first time in years for kids for Christmas. This is a huge help in relieving some stress. With no markets, both husband and wife have taken even more losses because they were both artists or are. This will help keep me connected to my international family. The Spanish resources will be so helpful. And we found that especially important for our international community, that sense of isolation and, you know, no prospect of travel and just connecting to folks that aren't close. One last one that one recipient said, I'm overwhelmed. My legs are shaking. And I think it was overwhelming because this program was really great in the way that there wasn't you know this burden to get all this information for our recipients. In our case, all of our artists are Indigenous, so we knew that everyone qualified, and so we were able to hand over these resources with very little. Sometimes getting resources is like applying for a job, and you never know if you're going to get it. You don't know if you said the right things. And so this was an amazing program where we were just able to hand things out and tell folks, you decide what you need to make this happen, because we all have different needs, and we definitely recognize that in this project. And I did want to recognize Commissioner Hardesty's comments early about quality. I think this is a great first step, and I appreciate all the work that was done. And I think this it was this amazing gift for folks, especially for folks that a lot of our folks fall through the cracks, and so we say underserved. Some have never been served, and don't even know, you know, how to connect to resources. And so all these resources were amazing, but it also kind of opened, I think, a lot of eyes to just how much technology does cost. And when you're talking about quality, you're talking about thousands of dollars for one device. And when you have that comfort and you have that quality, you don't really question it. It's just what you do, because that's what we need to survive right now. But when you don't have any of that connectivity or any of that quality, anything does help, and I really appreciate, I think the laptops or the Chromebooks were super excellent, and especially for folks just like toddlers can work them. elders can access them. But again, it just kind of opened our eyes to this, like that they're just like this tiny little step into the world of technology. And for folks that are taking that first step, like it's like, oh, and then you need better internet service. And then you need, you know, then you are ergonomic keyboards because we're on, and those are not cheap. And so all these things, because we're online all the time now too, if unfortunately, you know, and then the not only that, but then the knowledge of all these programs that are now, you know, really in I don't know what the numbers are, but I would venture to say 90% of jobs you need to have some kind of digital knowledge and work these digital programs, which more than, and I worked in the kitchen industry for 17 years. And so I recognize, you know, that there are industries where you don't need to, but even those industries now are online and you need to know how to, navigate the orders online and things like that. So just the needs are great, and really appreciate this program to be able, our organization has only worked with government programs a couple of times, but in my experience, sometimes it can be burdensome, and it puts us in a strange position of like haves and have nots and time and power. But this program was really well thought out and rolled out. The timing of stuff, you know, could have been better, but again, I think we all recognize that digital devices are in such high demand, and you know, everything's shipping, everything. So big thank you. We're putting our card in the mail, our thank you card to the team, because we really just really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. So many good points about access and government programs. I think we've learned a lot through the process and hope to use that knowledge in future programs. So last but not least, I'm going to turn it over to Ryan from Human Solutions as our last speaker.
Good morning, can everyone hear me? Great.
Yep, you sound good.
Challenging always. Good morning, Mayor, members of City Council. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to be before you this morning. My name is Ryan Winterberg-Lipp, and I'm a senior project manager in the Affordable Housing Development Department at Human Solutions. And we're a nonprofit CDC serving low-income people in East Portland, and we are included and involved in the Digital Inclusion Network through some of my colleagues. So we have been doing this work in East Portland for about 30 years. We do a range of things. We develop and own affordable housing. We operate 3 shelters, and we provide a range of services, including housing stability, youth programming, and employment programming, all of which have really been tested and grown and evolved quite a lot in COVID. We also own 16 affordable housing properties. We have 3 more in our pipeline that when we're done, will total about 900 units, and that's kind of the work that I do. So I'm here to offer to you a little bit about what we've learned about the importance of digital connectivity, capacity building from our work serving low-income families in our housing, and particularly in this rapidly evolving COVID environment where we're all really being tested. And I think a lot of what I've learned from talking to my colleagues as well really enforces the conversation this morning, what our other speakers have mentioned, and points to some opportunities that we think there are for bring this work forward. So, each of our affordable housing properties, so all 16 of them, has a resident services manager that helps residents navigate the range of needs to maintain their housing stability, so whatever it is that they need in their daily lives. And when schools transitioned to remote learning last spring, that's really where Human Solutions resident services staff jumped in and helps students and families navigate this like brand new digital world. So what we learned is that the high cost of internet service meant that many of our families, like we've heard today, didn't have internet service at all at the onset of COVID. So that was just a huge disruption to their learning, particularly to students in schools that didn't have connectivity at all. And so prior to COVID, we think that about 10% of our families that were involved in our youth programming services didn't have, only 10% had computers at all. So 90% didn't have computers in their home to start with. And like we've heard, most people used their cell phones for their tech needs, but they often didn't have the newest technology. They didn't have unlimited data. So resources that don't work for digital school and digital work in this like rapidly evolving world. And over time, the school districts that we worked with began to step up, and they provided low cost internet access through some of the existing programs. When school started up again in the fall, some of these programs you've probably heard about, but like what Commissioner Hardesty relayed, we really found that the lower speeds were just not sufficient to support multiple students working at once, multiple kids trying to stream or watch video lessons, upload their assignments, all that stuff. It's really data intense, and the basic internet service packages available to low-income people really just don't support that level of connectivity, and we heard that it was really frustrating and demoralizing for kids who were trying really hard to stay engaged and to do their work, but they were sometimes quite literally being shut out of their classes and couldn't upload their assignments. So we've learned that that kind of bare minimum service just really isn't sufficient, and we found that it wasn't equitable. So when our resident services staff heard about these challenges, our youth programming staff began to offer funding assistance to help residents pay for higher internet speeds, but we found that sometimes the families were really concerned that they would get locked into unaffordable plans that they would have to pay for going forward once the support dried up, and they'd been burned by like these inflexible and predatory contracts before, so they were understandably very concerned about taking that kind of assistance when they couldn't maintain it. It's just really indicative, we think, some of the trade-offs that low-income people make when they're, you know, weighing the bills that they pay every month and kind of the resulting stress that it pays on the family. And our colleagues who work directly in services want to relay that quality internet access in the ideal world has to really be provided at no cost. So that's not one of the monthly trade-offs that families are making. We also found that while tablets and laptops began to flow through school districts, adults and students really struggled to navigate it. And even where we have systems in place through some of our youth programming that works on-site with families, building that capacity to use technology is really work that's built on relationships and meeting people where they are and one-on-one, which it was really, frankly, challenging to do in a COVID environment. So that was another challenge we experienced. But from the affordable housing developer owner perspective, we know about these challenges. So we've been exploring ways to provide free internet access to people in our housing properties so that it's free to everyone, and we're building it in at the start of construction. And so just as a recent example, we're working on a project now that we hope to start construction on in the spring. And even though we've been negotiating with the internet service providers, the cost for us as an affordable housing developer to provide the internet infrastructure can easily reach $100,000. And then every year as an annual operating expense, it's tens of thousands of dollars. So which is something that the budgets of affordable housing properties, just it's something that they can't typically economically bear. But it's something that we continue to strive to negotiate on like a project-by-project basis. So from that perspective, we are really excited for opportunities to develop solutions to infrastructure, to service cost solutions, to digital literacy at a scale. So we really think there's an opportunity for the city to partner with CDCs like Human Solutions and other affordable housing providers to come up with more holistic system-wide solutions rather than what we're able to do just through individual projects, individual negotiations, individual relationships and programs. So we're super excited for this work, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ryan. So that concludes all of the speakers. So I just first want to thank all of the speakers for their time today. I think there was a lot of information conveyed. I also, commissioners, just want to let you know that I was able to listen in on the priorities work session last week. I really see a connection between your citywide priorities and digital equity. Like I said, many of the speakers are able to stay on, but I've also invited the Bureau of Technology Services, Kevin Martin from the Smart Cities Program, and then the MHCRC Technology Grants Program manager as well, if you have any questions. So two things that I want you all to be thinking about is, what do you believe is the responsibility of the City of Portland? What is within our realm of work that we should be doing? Where should we be focusing? Which bureaus should be involved in that work? How should it be organized? And then we'll get to it, but what additional information do you need to help make decisions on where we go from here? So I'm gonna pause there and just allow for commissioners to ask questions. If you know who you want to direct your question at, feel free to do so. Otherwise, I can help facilitate that.
Very good. Let me go ahead and jump in while people are considering raising their hands. Number one, what is the responsibility? Let's start with the broader responsibility to the community. The world has moved on, and COVID moved us there at the speed of light. And I think we all acknowledge that digital access is a must-have for everybody. You cannot expect to be a full participant in the workforce. You cannot expect to have access to all of the educational resources that are available if you don't have access to digital resources. And maybe most importantly, you don't have access to information that informs our daily lives without access to digital resources. So I would say the goal should be clearly stated. And from my perspective, the goal is 100% access for everyone. Now the question becomes, what is the city of Portland's role in that? I would say we are one of many partners. I think it would be a mistake for the city of Portland to unilaterally take full responsibility for what is a huge undertaking. If you agree with the goal as I stated it, city of Portland cannot accomplish that goal alone. Not now, not 10 years from now, not 20 years from now. We are a critical partner. I think the way that our bureaus can participate, and as you indicated, a number of bureaus that are already participating, but I could actually, you know, the obvious ones are obviously BTS, Bureau Planning and Sustainability, but somebody mentioned public safety, so now that brings in the Police Bureau. Somebody could bring in Recreation and Health, and that brings in the Parks Bureau. So really, it's an all hands on deck effort. I think, you know, digital access now becomes a overbearing responsibility for all of our bureaus. I would suggest we prioritize. And the presentations that we heard, which by the way were fantastic, I've sat through some dog work sessions from time to time. This was not one of those. This was fantastic. It was very informative, very well organized, and I really appreciated the diversity of our speakers and the level of personal passion and commitment definitely shone through, but I also just appreciated the technical information. But I didn't hear a clear prioritization. If we're gonna really create a digital plan, then that must start with prioritization. And I heard a couple of possibilities. I don't want to claim any monopoly on the truth, but I heard students as a potential first priority. I heard people who are needing access to digital resources for employment being an important priority, and making sure that, you know, consistent with our priorities around shared economic prosperity. That means obviously historically unserved or underserved communities need to be front and center. I could also make an argument though that employers should be providing that access to their employees as part of the deal of employment. I am somewhat reluctant, in fact, I'm very reluctant for us to be in the business of trying to once again pay for externalities that exist in the private sector. I do not want to pay for the digital resources that a company should be paying for their own employees so that they can make a profit. They should be working those costs into their business model and into their economic performance. So that's an area where I would look a little bit askance. I had a couple of specific questions related to the presentation. I was really intrigued by the polling results that showed, number one, strong support for government being, if not the lead, then certainly an active participant in this. This seems like one area where people trust government than maybe more than they trust their local utilities. So let's take a small victory when we can. But it was interesting that so many people said they wanted this without public safety being impacted. And I think it was about 60-ish plus. I didn't know what that meant. And so I'm wondering if you could go back to our consultant who's freezing to death in an ice storm in New Hampshire somewhere to maybe suss that question out a little bit. And then Elizabeth, I have a question. Director Perez, I'm sorry. I have a question. I've known you much longer as Elizabeth, so I apologize for that informality. I have a question about an estimate you put on the table. You said that if we had a penetration rate of a certain percent, I think it was 50-ish percent, at $80 a month, the cost of universal access, or at least a county-sponsored program, would be $1 billion. Then you went on to say, but people, you know, they're not going to pay $80. So the model doesn't work. The model fails, at least based on the polling that we did today. So that's not feasible. You came back and said what is feasible is you could charge $50 per month, but then you'd need a 60 to 70% participation rate, but you didn't fill in the variable, which is how much would that cost? And so I'd like to hear that. So that would be my second question. And my third question is related to government ownership of the infrastructure. And I've always been somewhat, I'm a huge proponent of maintaining infrastructure if it's related to utilities like sewer and water. I think we should control those utilities for obvious reasons. You don't want people trying, and we all know the parking meter example from Chicago where they tried privatizing their parking meters. And it was a colossal disaster. My concern about technology is slightly different, and that is technology shifts radically. And I'm worried that if we invest and create a city-owned or a county-owned infrastructure, what is the protection against a radical and immediate shift in technology that leaves our infrastructure vulnerable to being obsolete? And we've already seen this in some of the technology utility spaces. So those are my three questions that I would have. Number one, what did we mean by public safety impact? Number two, what is the variable if we went down to $50 a month and we're able to achieve that 60 to 70% penetration rate? And number three, what are communities that already have their own broadband networks doing to protect themselves from dynamic shifts in technology?
Thank you, Mayor, and I will turn it over to Tom to answer the first question.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Mayor. That question was asked on the qualitative online survey, and some of the comments, so that's kind of the what, some of the comments that came in related to that you would find, you know, later on when people are commenting just generally on their thoughts and things that they didn't get to say related to the specific questions, would indicate that they were more talking about the safety of the public rather than public safety as a an entity, you know, fire, police, those kinds of things. And what we surmised from the survey, plus what we've seen in other areas, sometimes they're talking about public health. And that's with all the new technologies, you know, the potential impacts, especially with, you know, electromagnetic radiation and those kind of things. The FCC, you know, came out not too long ago saying that they thought their standards from, I think, the 90s were just fine. That was an FCC under a different administration. You may see a new focus on that. Because there are so many technologies, so many of them use the wireless space, and I think there will be a relook at that. So that's one of the concerns. The other concern, though, that you find is that people, not just from an aesthetic point of view, people are concerned about, you know, some of the sizes of equipment boxes, especially switching centers, cabinets, things like that. in the right of way. And there have been documented cases, for instance, where they reduce the sight zones for both pedestrian and vehicular safety, where literally one case in Denver where a child riding on a bicycle came out from behind one of these boxes, a car could not see them and there was a collision.
We have been subjected to legal action for a very similar case here. So we're certainly aware of that concern from a risk management perspective.
Right. And so I think to kind of sum it up, I think that's where they were going with this. And they know that the local government has control over the rights of way. They do know that, you know, some of that's limited by federal and state enablements, but I think they're looking to the city and the county and the East County cities to really look at that and through whatever time, place, and manner restrictions they can place to ensure that, you know, the safety of the public continues to be paramount.
Thank you.
Okay.
Elizabeth, what's the variable?
Yes. So, so again, it would require a municipal broadband would require about 36% of customers to switch at $80 a month, and 60-70% of customers to take at $50 a month. And again, that is if we invest, you know, $1 billion in this system.
So the billion is actually not a variable. That is assuming $1 billion.
Yes.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. And the third question around technology shifts.
Sure. So the one thing that I will say is that I think for the foreseeable future, whatever technology changes, we're going to need that fiber backbone. So regardless of what technologies change, whether it's small cells, whether it's, I don't know, any number of things, that companies will come up with, you still need that fiber backbone. So we have to build that in anyway. I don't see that changing at all. And that's something that I know BTS is working on, is really expanding our footprint of our fiber. Now, the thing that I don't know is what we are able to use our fiber for. I do know that BTS owns fiber, and I know that PBOT owns fiber, and I think two other bureaus own fiber. So again, I think it's that coordination between all of the bureaus who own fiber and kind of that, what are we allowed to do with our own infrastructure going forward? And Jeff, if you want to jump in on kind of...
No, that I want to save time for my colleagues. Okay. That gives me a good understanding where we are today, and I appreciate that. Commissioner Hardesty, then Commissioner Rubio.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Director Perez. I think this is probably one of the most intriguing presentations I've ever had here at City Council. You are correct that many of my questions were answered through other speakers, but I want to cut to the chase. It feels like rather than holding cable companies accountable for gouging their communities, we are in fact trying to figure out how to prop up industries that actually don't reflect the public's needs. And I'll give you a great example, right? I had a very long conversation with my cable provider, and I found out that basically what I'm buying costs $60, but my monthly bill is $110. And my bill is $110 because I'm paying for sports that I never looked at and I don't care about on my TV. I am paying for rental of equipment that I didn't ask to rent it, right? But it's a part of the process. I am paying for a landline phone that I've never ever had in the history of having this cable service. And so aren't we actually doing this backwards? Where is our opportunity to actually change policy so that cable companies aren't allowed to gouge our customers in the way that we have seen it taking place? So that's kind of my first question. Was this survey or any information that was collected actually putting the blame where it belongs, which is in companies who say they provide one service and in fact they don't? As I think about the low-income service, we are not doing low-income communities any favor by giving them a pretend plan that actually doesn't provide for the needs that they have. So I didn't hear anybody talk about what is the responsibility on the cable companies to provide a service that people actually need and want and can afford.
I think you bring up really excellent points, and I think Yuvia touched on this as well, is getting locked into plans that people aren't aware of, being charged for services, not understanding their bill. These are all consumer protections that we have kind of seen fail in the last federal administration. So
failing for a long time, it just was exacerbated by the last administration.
Exactly. So I think there is work that we can do on the advocacy side, and we have been doing as the city of Portland to our federal counterparts. A lot of what guides telecommunications and cable right now is in ancient acts, the Telecommunication Act and the Cable Act, that really need to be revamped. So it's putting the pressure on the federal government to make those updates and then figuring out what we can do at the federal level. So right now we are in our negotiations with Comcast over our next 10-year franchise. And so within, you know, the reasonable path that keeps us, you know, within the law, how can we put pressure on these companies to change the way that they do business? So yeah. I think that is kind of a long-term thing that we continue to work on, and I think something that we can expend more resources on.
And another question is really about how are the school districts actually ensuring the educational needs of students who are having remote training challenges? What is their role and responsibility in making sure that every household has the appropriate equipment that they need in order to conduct an education program?
So I hesitate to speak for the school districts, and that's something that, you know, I can, again, reach out. I have been in communication with PPS and MESD. They have said that they are, you know, committed, but I do know that they've also been working with a lot of nonprofit organizations to reach the families that are really difficult to reach. So I think there's a lot of improvement we can see there. So that's something that I hope to work on with this council on making sure that all students are served.
So last legislative full session, there was $1 billion additional given to address the inequity that exists in our school districts. And I'm just trying to connect the dots that says, if we've given another $1 billion to school districts, and then here we are the city trying to figure out how to support the education programming of young people who are at home, you have a big partnership that's missing, which is on your committee. I didn't hear anybody representing school districts on that committee, right? So I think that's a big missing link to really having a fuller conversation about how we address the digital divide.
Agreed.
And I totally agree with the mayor. I think it would be insane for the city to see itself as the primary funder of cable companies that aren't providing services that are necessary for our community. So I would be challenged by that expectation as well. I'll stop there. I have a bazillion others, but I see all my colleagues have their hands up. So I'll stop and come back later at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner Rubio, then Commissioner Mapps, then Commissioner Ryan.
Thank you. And again, thank you, Director Perez. This was a very excellent presentation, very interesting and engaging. This is totally my jam. I also love the community partnerships and with the city, and I love the clear focus on frontline communities and developing solutions that are community-centered and community-based. And I, too, like Commissioner Hardesty and some of my other colleagues, am very interested in continuing to capacitate our communities, but also in engaging in longer-term planning that keeps the resources that we're paying out for this kind of access coming back into our local community and investing locally. So I have a two-part question. And this is for Jenny Lee and any of the community presenters that feel interested in responding. I'm interested in seeing what your idea of like what would a community-responsive, city-led digital infrastructure look like for you in the community, if you could look forward into the future. And then the second part of that question would be, And what is the one thing that we could do today that or the city could do in its role to invest or drive more focus to help us move in that direction?
So I think, unfortunately, Jenny had to hop off. So I'm wondering if one of our other community partners are able to speak to Commissioner Rubio's question.
This is Yuvia. I can just say that if, I mean, access would be the number one, what I envision, you know, that everybody would have a password to, you know, this connectivity. And also, as Joanne Hardesty has said a few times, and a couple others, just the kind of dominance that that providers play in our lives right now. And, you know, on every level, we depend on connectivity so much. And so, and there is a whole lot of mistrust for a whole lot of reasons with I would say every provider that is currently available right now, Comcast probably being the biggest one. I know some community members that, you know, their debt to a internet provider is so big that they're not going to be able to connect for quite a while. And that isn't because they did much of anything wrong, except for many of these issues that were brought up about equipment and contracts and things like that, where we're just slapped with a $2,000 bill that is more than a working class family can take on. And so I think, you know, and if you're able to address the connectivity kind of unilaterally, everybody, because I think also the quality of connectivity is a huge thing and puts us into different almost classes. And so if we're able to provide that as a city resource, then I think you're able to eliminate a lot of barriers that are superficial. They're put there to make money. And eliminate a lot of stress and distrust. Possibly if it's rolled out right, you're able to gain a lot of trust, but at least provide that connectivity. And I think in a time like right now, people need that flexibility where it's not related to their housing. It's not related to their phone bill. It's just there. It's there for everyone.
Napoleon, I see your hand up.
Okay, so what I would suggest is that a lot of companies such as Comcast, they brag about having the different levels of access, you know, student access or, you know, lower cost access to people with limited income. And I'm wondering if they can provide this, why can't the city or some type of one of the governments, the local governments, kind of force their hand into lowering the cost of long-term of access for many different people, instead of just only students or only low-income people or only people in this particular niche? Why can't they lower the cost, period? So it seems like the government does have the muscles to kind of enforce that. So even on your model where you're talking about having the $80 a month access and you have to have so many people that will participate, say if you convince Comcast to provide access for Multnomah County at this price and they'd have a guaranteed income, but it still wouldn't be the $50, $60, or $70 level, but a lower price that perhaps the city and the then Comcast could negotiate with. It just seems there should be a way to force them to provide more access to more people for lower costs, because they are making extreme amounts of profit. And of course they do have that level of distrust that pretty much everyone, you mentioned Comcast, they're upset because they've had different ways where they've been worked over by Comcast or know someone who has been worked over by them in the past. I'm done.
Agreed. Thank you. And that is definitely something we're looking into. I mean, there's definitely restrictions at the federal level, but I think there's a lot that we can still be doing. Commissioner Mapps, I believe your question is next.
Commissioner Mapps is up.
Thank you. A great presentation today from your team, Director Perez. My question is very much in the same lines of the discussions we just have been having. I'm wondering if we've had direct conversations with internet service providers, say Comcast, about providing services to low-income communities. I was just poking around the Portland Public Schools website, and I see that Comcast does have a program where they offer low-income families internet access for $9.95 a month. Seems like our survey suggests that the kind of sweet spot for paying for internet access is about, you know, $50 or something. So it seems like there should be some space here to make a deal, especially since they need to use the right-of-ways and whatnot. And I also would expect that Comcast and all the other internet service providers are ultimately interested in increasing their market penetration. So, I wonder if just a dialogue here might help us make some progress. And number one, do we have those kind of discussions? And if we wanted to have those kind of discussions, does that begin with your office? Is that something for intergovernmental relations or the mayor? Or how do we proceed from here?
Sure. Yeah, so we do have those conversations often. And they do happen in my office. But I'll just note, when we work with Comcast, we are working with their local representatives. I do think this is something that we can work with OGR, because again, whenever we have the conversations at the local level, they take it back to their headquarters, and it's this long conversation back and forth between the local representatives, who are wonderful, but can't necessarily make any changes without the corporate input. So I think going forward, further conversations with OGR, and again, trying to change things on the federal level is really where we can make the most difference.
Okay. I hope that we pursue that conversation, and thank you for that response.
Definitely. Commissioner.
Brian, you're up.
Brian.
Hello, Director Perez. Thank you for this great presentation by the collective partners, and also for the briefing last week. Many of the comments made, I would concur with, and I just wanted to add a couple, 2 cents, maybe to amplify a bit. I thought the dialogue we're having about the school children is so important because I think during COVID, it's been one of the gravest concerns about equity. I also think in your data, you show that there's a percentage increase once you get into East County, which often incorporates some of the same demographics of East Portland. So I know we've heard PPS mentioned, but really we need to think about partnerships with the school districts in East Portland that go into East County. And so I just wanted that on the record, whether it's Park Rose, David Douglas, Reynolds, Centennial. I'm glad Commissioner Hardesty brought up, because it was difficult to see the engagement with the school districts. There's been some information coming that shows that they are very involved. I guess my point is, when I asked about what solutions or what improvements could be made, there was mention of targeted investments or targeted strategies. So I would synthesize perhaps from some of our comments that some of those strategies would include, let's say, those living geographically east of 125th, and really prioritizing our housing stock where we see 5 school children in a 1-bedroom or 2-bedroom apartment. That gets right to the ground zero of where this divide is hitting the hardest. When I talk to my middle school, I've seen to know a lot of middle school teachers, they talk about those households, those usually apartments, as being those that are just really getting farther and farther behind. We always have summer melt of learning loss, but now we've had like a year of it. So I just hope that that dialogue and that targeted dialogue is in motion and continues. So I wanted to make that point. And
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And everything else, and I know I'm looking at the clock, I just want to say it was such a great presentation. And I appreciate that I want to end with this. You brought up how when you listen to us come to some consensus on our top 3 priorities, you were able to see how your work plan for 21-22 could totally get behind those three priorities with this work, whether it's economic prosperity, whether it's community safety, or whether it's houselessness, because houselessness gets to stability. And clearly this is part of one's stability now, is having that type of access at home. So I just really appreciate the way your brain's clicking, and it's a pleasure to have you on the team. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And just to round it out, I mean, one thing that I've heard from all of you is that, you know, this is not a Portland issue, or at least a city of Portland issue. This is a lot of convening that we need to do. I'll just, you know, I'm going to make a plug for this. You know, OCT has not settled yet into where we should be, whether we should remain our own office, whether it needs to be split up. I've spent the last 2 years really, you know, working on these issues as well as right-of-way issues. And I think, you know, for us to really make that progress, we need that mandate from City Council saying, you know, this is the Bureau to do it, or to point out which Bureau should be doing this. So that is going to be, you know, the thing that I work with you all on in the next few months, is where do we want to go from here? And if it is with OCT, let's get moving. And if it's not, then we can do it in another Bureau. But I don't think that this work can wait. And I will have some budget asks. No, that is coming. But I think, you know, the digital divide has only been exacerbated through COVID. We have a lot of short-term things that we're able to do, and really understanding, you know, what we can do with federal funds. But then what does the long-term plan look like for Portland, and where do we want to expend our resources? So I look forward to working with all of you in the next few months and coming years on really solving the digital divide.
Thank you. And Commissioner Hardesty, do you have one more comment?
Yes, I had one quick comment. Sure. Elizabeth Perez, I don't want to leave without saying that if we need to talk to the people at the top of our utility companies, I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I don't suspect any one of the elected leaders would shy away from that conversation. It is absolutely a conversation we must have, and we're here to help you have that conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that support.
All right, excellent presentation today. Great work session, colleagues. Those were provocative questions and insights. I feel like I'm walking away from this having learned a lot, and I'm inspired, and I'm really impressed with our community partners on this. We have a lot of work to do together going forward, and this was a great foundation to build from. So thank you, everyone, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.